finally.
Okay, cool. So the aim of the paper, the primary aim of the paper, is to explore what I see as being two varieties of eliminativism about mental representation at the subpersonal level that I think are often conflated, and doing this through the lens of the principle of inference to the best explanation. The visual theme is supposed to be science in action, and here we have eliminativism creeping up on the practicing scientist. But anyway, okay, so today I'm just going to give a brief introduction to inference, the best explanation. I'm sure you're all very familiar with the idea. I'm then going to look at three positions on the ontology of mental representation, before finally finishing by looking at the possibility that the ontology of mental representation is somewhat more nuanced than perhaps philosophers of cognitive science have been sensitive to in the past. And this roughly maps the structure of the paper as well. Okay, so here's the problem that I think contextualizes the paper. So representation talk, as we're all very familiar with, is ubiquitous in science, so everything from visual processing to social cognition, cognitive sciences are always evoking descriptions of representation. But representation seems to be a weird thing. So paradigmatically, a representation is taken to be a state, structure, or activity possessing content, and to possess content is to possess certain semantic properties like truth or accuracy conditions. So the idea is that if you have, say, take just a belief, let's assume beliefs for a moment are examples of representations, and if I believe that Paris is the capital of France, the idea is there are certain conditions on that belief which determine whether or not it actually is true. Likewise, a map, say, of Great Britain, again, there are conditions there determining whether the map successfully or fails to represent the real world. But paradigmatically, these semantic properties are fixed by individual or social norms. But of course, subpersonal representations, by definition, are unconscious states. They're not the target of these individual or social norms. And this is related to the problem of error, the infamous problem of error. So how is it we can make sense of a subpersonal state getting something wrong? That seems to be something we want a representation to be able to do. How is it possible for something that's presumably just part of the ordinary, unconscious causal world to be able to get something wrong? And this problem is the reason why many are lured by the promises of eliminativism. Okay, so two claims really in the paper I want to make. So first of all, there's an important distinction between a priori and a posteriori eliminativism. And a priori eliminativism faces two challenging obstacles. And I'm not particularly trying to come down hard on any particular position in this paper. I'm mostly interested in getting to grips with the conceptual landscape. But as I say, I do think there are two big obstacles for the a priori eliminativist. And finally, that we should respect the possibility that the ontological landscape of mental representation may be a bit more messy or nuanced, with realism, eliminativism, and fictionalism coexisting. I actually think that the claims of the paper might come across as being sort of obvious, in which case, great, that's perfect. But I do think that in practice, that some of these issues are ignored, and particularly with the first point, I think these things are, even the people who are supposedly championing them often conflate them. Okay, so very briefly, inference the best explanation says that we ought to believe that our best theories are true. So if our best theory of astrophysics and astronomy says that there is a black hole at the center of a galaxy, then we ought to believe that there is a black hole at the center of our galaxy. If our best theory of dinosaur extinction was that there was some cataclysmic meteorite impact, then we ought to believe there was some kind of cataclysmic meteorite impact. So trying to briefly formulate this, given some evidence E and a list of explanations, T1, T2, and so on of E, if some explanation Ti of E is the best, we can infer that Ti is approximately true if Ti meets the standards of adequate explanation. And what the standards of adequate explanation is doing there is it's imposing some minimal epistemic standards. So it means that if you have a bunch of terrible explanations, the best one we don't have to infer to be true. There are different ways of formulating IV, and I discussed that a little bit in the paper, but I just sort of put that up here for getting to grips with it today. And it's worth noting that there is a lot of controversy over IVE in the philosophy of science. It's by no means, sort of consensus view that IVE is correct, or that it's a rational principle. But it certainly is entrenched in everyday inference and scientific practice. And for the rest of this talk, I'm just going to kind of assume it to be true. Okay, and then very briefly, just to give a bit of flavor to this, Darwin's often quoted as a real-life scientist who explicitly endorsed IVE. He wrote, "It can hardly be supposed that a false theory would explain in so satisfactory a manner as does a theory of natural selection the several large classes of facts above specified. It has recently been objected that this is an unsafe method of arguing, but it is a method used in judging of the common events of life as often been used by the greatest natural philosophers." All right, so putting that to the side for one moment, here are three positions on the ontology of mental representation. So first of all, we have realism. And realism basically says that, okay, so given the principle of IVE and given the actual work done in cognitive science, we can say that descriptions of representations are true. A posteriori elementivism starts off with a similar kind of methodology, says, right, great, yeah, we've got IVE, let's look at the actual empirical work that's done, but it turns out that the descriptions of representations, if they're there, are false, because in fact our best explanation is a non-representational one. A priori elementivism is a little harder to summarize, but it essentially says that we don't even need to look at the evidence because there is just a conceptual problem with representation. Our best explanations cannot include representational talk because to do so is to make some kind of category error. Okay, I'm going to look at that in a bit more detail in a moment. So just a couple of things to note here. So I think that the realists and a posteriori elementivists, although I characterized them there as adopting two separate positions, are actually two sides of the same coin, because they believe they take the same methodology, which is again is sort of adopting IBE and looking at the evidence. They just come to different conclusions about what that evidence says. So what you don't get very often is a kind of global a posteriori elementivism, somebody who says there are in principle representations, but in fact there aren't any. There are some examples in literature, and we can talk about that in discussion if you'd like, but most a posteriori elementivists are local elementivists. I also haven't mentioned the possibility, again, of rejecting IBE, so that is another option. If you're, say, an a priori elementivist, you might just want to get rid of IBE altogether because perhaps you think best explanations don't map onto truth or whatever, but I'm not going to discuss that today. And also I should mention that even for the most sort of hardcore a priori elementivists, they can still consistently hold on to the notion of representations as a temporary gloss. But it's important to realize that any description you make using representations is going to be false, but you're just evoking it as part of some kind of, you know, function of some human epistemic limit. So you're reluctantly accepting that for the time being anyway, you're going to have to continue talking about representations. And also just to note that neither of the elementivisms that I talked about are identical to a elementivism about folk psychology, and this is also a confusion in the debate. So if you're a elementivist about propositional attitudes, you don't necessarily need to be an elementivist about representations at the subpersonal level. And again, this is something we can talk about more in the discussion. Okay, so here is the argument from realism, which is probably fairly predictable by this point. So IBE is a rational epistemic principle. According to IBE, we ought to believe, at least tentatively, in the truth of our best scientific explanations. Our explanations in cognitive science ascribe mental representations. We ought to believe in the truth of explanations that posit mental representations. We ought to believe in the truth of mental representations. So just formalizing a little bit more of what we've already said. Okay, and just a few notes on a posteriori elementivism. Again, they accept IBE and representational explanation in principle, but conclude that some so-called representational phenomena are better explained without representations. So as an example, in recent literature, you have Nico Orlandi arguing that when it comes to visual processing, the phenomenon is best understood in ecological terms rather than traditional inferential representational terms. But she does very much accept that there are some domains of cognitive science where we do need to hold on to the notion of representation.
Could you just let me see the previous
slide? Sure. So really just saying what I've already said, but it's just didn't... Yeah.
I just want to see if there's anything.
What was the...
Okay, fine. And then on the next slide, I just need to see...
The visual scientist, the visual processing with Nicole Orlandi.
Yeah, Orlandi. O-R-L-A-N-D-I. Okay. And the... She's got lots of papers on it, but if her book is called The Innocent Eye, Why Vision is Not a Cognitive Process... I believe, and it came out in 2014, I think.
Okay.
And actually, that's an it's an interesting example because a lot of the responses to Orlandi have been have emphasized the very recent empirical work, which they think refutes her argument, but this evidence didn't exist prior to her writing this book. So there's sort of within that debate, there seems to be a lot of consensus on what counts as the kind of correct methodology. Yeah, we can talk more about this later. Okay, so a priori eliminativism. So I'm not sure anyone in the literature actually calls himself an a priori eliminativist, but I think that we can find something close to a priori eliminativism in the work of so-called radical inactivists. I think there are some predecessors to this. I think some of the work by people like Ryle and the behaviorists might be a prior element to this, perhaps.
Yes, have you come across the Sussex personality of Inman Harvey?
No, I do not.
He's a figure here. He's retired now, but yeah. He's anti-representationalist views loom large.
Oh, really?
In this university. Well. And I'd say he'd probably be an a priori eliminativist.
Okay, well, that sounds
just something incoherent about the idea of talking of internal representations at all.
Okay, well, that's definitely worth looking up then.
He's not a philosopher, but he does give philosophers a run for the money, so he's worth... He's like Sterling, no?
Yeah.
He's figuring out why he's wrong.
So what field does he come from?
He's a... adaptive systems. He's one of the original evolutionary adaptive systems people, so evolutionary robotics. Okay. And he's probably originally a... Well, he's originally a moccasin smuggler or something, but...
A sock importer.
Yeah, sock importer. From Afghanistan, but he's
mathematics. He says he's an engineer. Physics.
And his name is?
Inman, which is a name steeped in the history of the Sussex. Inman Harvey, another name steeped in the history of Sussex.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. Anyway, this is the argument, quickly summarized, of the radical inactivists. You don't need to worry too much about the details of this for now, but I'll go through it anyway. So the radical inactivists essentially say that our best theories of content claim that content is constituted by information. But content necessarily involves semantic properties, as we saw earlier. Our best theory of information as covariance, or something along those lines. Information as covariance cannot explain the semantic properties of content. Information cannot explain content. Our best theories of content are false. Okay, I mean, these guys want to say that, I mean, they're not total eliminativists across the board. They think that content arises at the person level through things like intersubjectivity and linguistically mediated norms and that kind of thing. Okay, but the important point, I think, here is regardless of the argument, the core of it is that there's some kind of category error being made. You cannot apply, if you say something like the storm roared, if you take that metaphor literally, you're just making some kind of category error because storms are not the kind of thing that can roar. Something similar is happening with representations and content with it. Okay, so here are two challenges for a priori eliminativism. So first of all, predictably, the challenge from IBE. So how do you reconcile the apparent untenable ontology of mental representations with their apparent productivity? So if representations really are so ubiquitous in cognitive science, and they seem to be doing good work, at least a lot of the time, why is it that this ontology is so problematic? and relatedly, the challenge from optimism. So the limitedist must establish an a priori divorce of the debate from the independent appraisal of accounts of mental representation. So philosophy of mind, according to science over the last sort of, you know, 40, 50 years has tried to naturalize content. There's no consensus on that, but you might hold out for a kind of optimism. You might think, if you're a realist, well, look, representations are doing all this good work, so we should assume that representational descriptions are true and just hold out for some kind of future account. Or perhaps we've already got the account, we just haven't reached a consensus on what the best one is yet. So the limitedist has to convince us that no possible account in the future, our account that exists today, can account for these sorts of semantic properties. Okay. Now, this is a response, I think, that the a priori limitivist can give to the first problem, although I think it is part of a sketch to a more general strategy, sort of a sketch to a broader strategy. In the paper, I do discuss as well a response to challenge from optimism, but as we're time constrained today, I'm just going to look at this one. So I think the a priori limitivist can say that, okay, descriptions of representations do feature in our best theories, but hold that the explanatory power of these descriptions is not identical to the properties of representation. So there's something about representation which is doing the good work, and that's why they're part of our best theories. But this concept of representation is coming with this baggage that we need to get rid of. So descriptions of representations feature in our best theories because there is indeed something contained within the notion of representation that is highly explanatory. But not all the conditions on representation are explanatory. And it's these conditions like content that are so problematic and why we haven't been able to successfully naturalize content. Okay, so...
I'm sorry, can you
hear that? Yeah,
yeah. I just want to
slide
you
around. Okay, and actually something I should have said is there's something to the response, but there is also a problem with it, which I discussed in the paper, and we can talk about that.
Are these somebody's responses?
No, these are my responses. On behalf of, yeah. So I think there's something to it, but I think there's also a problem, and we can talk about that. Likewise for their response to the challenge from optimism. Okay. So something I haven't mentioned so far is the possibility of fictionalism, which is a sort of third way or fourth way, depending on how you're counting. And fictionalism essentially says, fictionalism agrees with the realists that representations are here to stay and that they're doing good work in calling to science. But at the same time, they agree with the a priori limitivist that descriptions of representation are fundamentally false. So take a statement such as neural pattern Y represents X. This is taken to be false, but serves some kind of epistemic purpose. An epistemic purpose which is not easily eliminated. In some way, it's going to be here to stay. So the fictionist wants best of both worlds. They want to avoid the challenge of naturalizing content, whilst at the same time removing the hard sell burdening limitism, which is to turn around and say to the content science, look, you know, these descriptions you're making all the time are false, and we need to get rid of them. One of the problems with fictionalism is it still faces the problem of IBE, still has to say, why is it given that descriptions are everywhere, we shouldn't just infer that they're true, they need to provide some account of that. I won't talk much about that right now.
Can you give an example of a statement that a fictionalist, not in this area, just to get the idea of what fictionalism is?
Okay, so you might...
Sure,
so you might be a fictionist about mathematical objects, for example. You might think that we need to keep talking about numbers as if they're real, but they're not. So statements about numbers in the abstract are somehow fundamentally false, but we need to keep talking about them because they're indispensable epistemically. In the same way that...
What matters about truth? I think a lot of people who buy IBE wouldn't notice a difference. They would just say... Yeah, if it's the best explanation, then that means we should. If this talk is the best explanatory talk, then this is the talk that we should endorse. And the fact that you add on, well, is it true? what's going to hinge the difference between, I just want to know the difference between fictionalist and the realist.
So there might not be any difference when it comes, in fact there won't be any difference when it comes to scientific practice. There will only be a difference metaphysically. So, I mean, you might think that fictionalism is perhaps closer to the limitativist gloss in that perhaps it's somewhat dependent on the context of your science at the time, so maybe one day it will no longer be epistemically useful. In the same way that maybe one day we'll stop talking about numbers. But certainly given the context of science today, it doesn't seem likely. Seems
that's,
like it's...
I don't want to press this too much, but that's the same with realism. Because all realists admit that their theories could be... As a matter of fact, the pessimistic induction suggests that we definitely will give up our theories if the past is any guide. So anyway, I don't want to...
Sure, we can, we can talk about this in discussion. So finally, I just want to make the suggestion that... so one of the reasons I mention fictionalism is because fictionalists claim that to provide a way to continue talking in the way that we do whilst avoiding problematic metaphysical arguments. So fictionalism and eliminativism provide two ways to talk about representations whilst rejecting their truth. On the one hand, we have these... temporary glosses from the limitivists. On the other hand, we have these useful fictions on the part of the fictionalists. So really we have three ways of talking about representations. We have the realists, so we have real ways of talking about representations, temporary glosses, and useful fictions. Okay, but it's worth noting that it's consistent to be a realist about representations within one domain, given state of the art and inference the best explanation, and an eliminativist or fictionalist in another domain, at least an a posteriori eliminativist. Even still, you might be an a priori eliminativist and still think that, and still be a fictionalist in some domain. That does seem to be consistent, though, a slightly odd position. But certainly, when it comes to a posteriori eliminativism, that doesn't seem impossible. So, coming back to the Nick Orlandi example with visual processing, you might think that, well, look, here's one domain where you have, where we're going to get rid of representations given the evidence. We're going to be realists about representations where we don't seem to be able to get rid of them. And we're just going to be limitivists about other domains and think that at best what we have is a kind of temporary gloss. So here's another example. So in recent years, philosophers have attempted to develop this notion of structural representation, where they make sense of a representation as a kind of action-guiding, structure-preserving state akin to something like a map. And fallouts from this theory is that many of the things that have been called representations historically are representations, but many of the things aren't. So it delineates the real representations differently from traditional cognitive science. So the theory of S representation and with the elimination, also I should mention, so one of the things that S representation theorists want to get rid of is this notion of receptor representation. So receptor representation is supposed to be something that's called a representation, but all it's doing is kind of mere stimulus response, correlated activity with some kind of stimulus in the environment. And it's dependent on the presence of that stimuli in the environment for its activity. This is what they call receptor representations, and they think these aren't real representations. So one of the effects of this is that you get rid of some of the old representations, but you also keep some. So... the theory of S representation is consistent with the acceptance that sometimes needs demand that we still refer to those states, such as receptor representations, as representations, either perhaps as a fiction or as a temporary gloss. So the lesson here is commitment to realism in one domain does not prevent commitment to limitativism or fictionalism in another.
Sorry, so how does S representation eliminate receptor representation?
So I went over that very quickly. So basically... S representation theorists say that the only thing that count as genuine representations are states which function to preserve the structure of their target and are exploited by a system to guide behavior towards that target. So often the analogy of a map is used. So the way that a map represents the idea goes as some kind of isomorphism or weaker morphism relation to the target, and the system, most of the time us, exploits that isomorphism to navigate around the real world. So the idea is that there's a kind of there's a richer notion of representation there. So the characters are real representation have to meet certain stronger criteria than maybe traditional cognitive science has described.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So maybe just to speak your language, you'd want to on the third bullet point to make your I'm just checking to make sure I understand your point.
Mm-hmm.
You want to put in the first line of the third bullet point, you say, and with it the elimination or fictionalization of so you're trying to say
that's right. All right, so to conclude then, eliminativism about mental representations is best understood as delineating two separate camps, a posteriori and a priori eliminativism. And this respects two distinct sets of motivations and arguments. And again, this might seem really obvious, but I think if you look at the work of the radical activists, if you read something like Dan Hutto or Eric Mines' Radicalizing and Activism from 2013, it's not always clear whether they're providing an a priori or an a posteriori argument. So I think it's even for eliminativists, it's good to get straight on what exactly the argument is. And that recreation, that argument I gave earlier on behalf of the radical eliminativists was me sort of recreating what a kind of a priori argument I think that they could give, but it's not always entirely clear in the actual work what it is they're doing. Okay, and then secondly, in the sense of a weaker point, foster results to be sensitive to the various nuanced possibilities of the ontological landscape of mental representation, possibilities that may lie between inflexible theoretical abstractions. So I think often, for example, you know, realists become kind of defensive, but realists should be open to the possibility that, okay, maybe there are some domains where it's better to make sense of the descriptions of representations as useful fictions or as temporary glosses pending a better understanding. And that's us. Okay.
Yeah, because you mentioned that in this book before. I mean, I was just wondering, do you think that the sort of new notion of representation which is creeping in, you know, where representation is this arbitrarily deep hierarchy of Bayesian models, does this cut the cake here in any way differently, or does this all this just stay the same?
So, something that I've thought about, this isn't really entirely my own thought, somebody else writes on this, Gladzitsky, I don't know how you pronounce his name, I think, writes about this. So he thinks that the representations that are present in predictive coding are actually a kind of structural representation because they function to map the causal structure of the world or something like that. So here representations are something like that's all I'll say because without having worked on it for a while, I don't want to say too much. But yeah, I think that's what he would say and what I've sort of considered.
So it does cut the cake differently, or it doesn't?
I guess if you buy that idea of the representations present in predictive coding as being essentially just structural representations, then I'm not sure it does cut the cake differently because, I don't know. It depends on sort of the, perhaps, does it depend on the empirical credentials of predictive coding? Does that matter whether you think that's the case? I mean, obviously, there's kind of concerns about the predictive coding stuff.
I guess
about
they would claim that the empirical credentials are kind of better than usual.
Sure, yeah. And in that case, you might think that it doesn't cut the cake differently because, you know, our best theory essentially the claim is a sort of IBE one where you see the best explanation given the evidence is that there are these kinds of structure representations, and so we ought to believe there are these representations and understand the mind that way. Certainly, obviously, one of the fallouts of predictive coding is that it might change how we think about representations in some way. You know, you don't have this kind of traditional inferential sort of approach, but
they're not floating quite so freely as
sure.
This kind of
yeah.
Abstract.
I think that's right. I think that's right. Yeah.
Is it not that Andy feels that the predictive processing framework is agnostic on these questions, right? So he introduces things like radical predictive coding
mm.
and alien world, so these can totally accommodate all this kind of fictional representations and so on and so on. I think he sees it as a new arena, but not an arena that solved any of these questions, right? Actually, he comes down on the side of representations, so that's pretty much what he was saying in his talk, right?
Yeah.
He sees things that have, like, they're a useful way of understanding the world, but reality processing itself is silent on these questions.
So I think that might be right. So the kind of picture I just painted there is, in a sense, an additional theory to interpret what predictive processing is saying. So you need some kind of additional theory to make sense of whether there are representations or not in predictive voting.
Mm-hmm.
You might be right that in and of itself it's silent on it, and you can take like a... Actually, I can think... I know about one graduate student in Edinburgh who takes that sort of approach. They think that predictive coding is consistent with and makes sense of the kind of inactivist picture at the most extreme end, and that soon we won't be talking about representation anymore. Thanks for predictive coding.
Oh, really? So predictive coding drives you that way?
Yeah, because it rescues inactivism from certain problems.
Oh, really?
I can give a voice to that view. It's not my view, but in honor of Simon McGregor, who couldn't be here today, who'd like to be here today, he's been throwing around the idea that. That because if you take seriously at the active inference version of predictive coding, the Friston view, where it's not just one direction fit but the other direction fit as well, that you actually perform actions that maximize the likelihood of your model, then he points to the problem that you can't really decide whether something is a traditional representation that it's trying to match the world or whether it's trying to change the world so that it matches well. And he says that shows that the representational analysis is flawed, that basically it's not. So it's a kind of a priori, using predictive coding as a kind of a priori argument against representationalism, and therefore he embraces a more inactive, non-representationalist view.
Okay.
Just from the nature of predictive processing itself, he thinks that you can derive a flaw with the traditional representational.
Has he written anything on this?
No.
Analysis of what he's been saying, but it might be very inaccurate.
I mean, in his last talk, I think he went the same line as Andy, saying that he's kind of agnostic. He says, I understand that active inference. So without active inference, then predictive coding deeply falls into the hands of the representationalist in my eyes, right? And then active inference sort of makes things less clear, and that's what Andy's really stressed in his book, right? So Hoey's interpretation of predictive coding is deeply representational, right?
Yeah.
And because he's separating action and perception so cleanly, it's where Andy's kind of muddied the waters. And I think Simon's the same thing, that it's not clear. There isn't a necessary drive towards representation or predictive coding, but I still think he's agnostic on which way the framework...
Say, I don't know what his view is, but he's at least voiced this argument. Mm. I'm pretty sure it's his argument in that he authored it, but it doesn't mean it might be an objection that he thinks he needs to overcome or something, but whether or not what his position is towards it is not the main thing. The main thing is there seems to be an argument here that predictive coding could be fundamentally at odds with a representational account. I don't buy it, but at least it would be something that somebody writing a thesis on this might want to respond to.
I think what this partly points to is this problem where often in the history of philosophy or cognitive science, we've started off with a framework, whether that's the classical computational framework or the predictive coding framework, and we kind of think that we, just by looking at this framework alone, we're going to conclude whether or not there are definitely, finally, mental representations. But it's a difficult starting point because you don't really have any theory to get to grip with to interpret that framework. Now it turns out that there are lots of accounts of computational mind which exercise representations. You can be a computationalist and not talk about representations at all, which people may even realize, even 20 years ago or something. So perhaps again the problem is with whether or not you think predictive coding drives really strong realist representations like Friston or in a kind of radical nativism like this guy, which is going to depend on your theory of representation. You better get clear on that first before you even look at you know, what counts, what are the victory conditions here.
Doesn't it definitely, you know, rule out this distinction between sort of receptor representationalism and fictionalized representation, because it very naturally accommodates both, you know, the receptor representation right down in the depths of the hierarchy, the higher fictionalized representation at the top.
I think somebody like Adrian Downey, who can't make it today, has a fictionalist and activist approach to predictive coding, I think. So we should ask him.
They probably, yeah. Right.
Yeah, hopefully he'll be here in the future.
Yeah.
It's about at least one person to respond to McGregor's argument, but at least one person decades ago, explicitly embraced that two-headed nature of representations that didn't take it as a reductio ad absurdum, but just embraced it. So Ruth Millikan quite explicitly embraced the idea of, she called it push me, call you representations, referencing Dr. Doolittle, this beast that had heads at both ends. And so she said there were these representations that both had the philosophical terms of something like alethic and hedonic or something like that, that they both are trying to match the world or trying to represent the world, and the direction of it is both ways, trying to match the world, but also trying to express some kind of preference at the same time. So at least she didn't think it was a reductio.
Yeah.
She embraced it, so maybe there's more work to be done there.
Yeah.
I mean, also, doesn't the predictive coding thing, it blows apart the notion of, you know, correlation in a sense, because yes, you know, a richly hierarchical representational structure is exploiting correlation, right? But also not, right? You could be doing different things at different levels of hierarchy. You know, the highest level, this is maybe absolutely nothing.
Right,
it's a fantasy.
There's a sense in which the predictions are kind of future oriented.
Well, you can have a hierarchical structure of descriptions which are correlated, joined to the real world, the sensory input or whatever it is, at the bottom level, and at the top is complete fantastic nonsense.
Sure.
So, you know, that idea that it's either correlation or non-correlation, surely that's got to be got rid of now.
Well, now you find IVD applying, it's kind of, we're getting the opposite of meta, where we're going down from the meta down to the object level, and so IVD is normally meant to apply to our theories, but one of the theories, that is the predictive coding theory, is saying that what goes on inside us is this kind of inferential process, and it's claiming that, I think, so at least some of them, maybe not the inactive variants, but the traditional, the more conservative predictive coding theorists would say, there's that your picture is not possible. If it really is having to meet the incoming data and predict it correctly, and it's doing that, and it's coming up with the model that is the Bayesian best explanation, then the high-level stuff will have to have some connection to it. I think that's who he's hoped. Is that, I'm trying to say that. I think that's his hope, that it, because you have this optimal algorithm, and you have to meet the data, then you will have some connection to, it'll at least be fictive, it'll at least be useful.
Yeah, but that's clearly false, right? Because, you know, at each level of hierarchy, you're basically introducing arbitrary amounts of uncertainty, right? So, you know, as you're getting up, the sort of degree of correlation or concreteness is potentially decreasing to any amount you want.
But so the Common and Ashby argues against that, right? That every good, so if you see the brain as a regulator, every good regulator is a model of the system that is regulating. I think this is how Annal alludes to, right? So that there's got to be something representational in that hierarchy if it's going to do its job well.
Well, it just seems that the position allows there not to be. It can, you know, the top levels can be arbitrarily divorced.
Well, if you're right, we can go meta and reapply it to just debates about the philosophy of science and say, well, if you're right about this network not having necessarily any connection with the truth, even though it has taken these ideally rational steps all along the way, that is the best explanation in according to some criterion, then that means that we shouldn't believe that our theories, which are the best explanation, have any correspondence to reality or any truth, if you don't want to talk about correspondence, don't have any truth whatsoever. I mean, it seems like there's
well,
some,
no, because the IVD,
there's some connection here, one way or the other.
say that, right? Because, you know, you could say, well, we wouldn't believe that, because if you came up with a hierarchy that was basically introducing uncertainty in a way, which meant that when you got to the top, you were engaging in completely false theories of the world, right? That would not survive.
But that's what we're saying about the
mechanism for
predictive coding, is that it wouldn't survive, right? These networks wouldn't...
Yeah, but that's an extra tweak. I mean, the predictive coding thing actually allows you to have a hierarchy which is becoming increasingly divorced from...
No, it would show... I mean, I hate to be the voice of Friston here, but basically you'd say it would show up somewhere. He's the guy who wrote the Darwin objection, and so the response is, no, it'll show up somewhere. If it's a bad strategy, if this isn't a good theory, if it doesn't correspond to reality, then I'm going to have error. I'm not minimizing my free energy. There will be free energy that isn't being...
Well, yeah, but there's before and after. So before you minimize the error, you know, you may be increasingly deploying a sort of fantastical...
This is a familiar area. I mean, he's going to appeal to the in the limit, or, you know, after evolutionary time...
Multiple times.
So that's a familiar...
But the actual, just the conception of representation itself, I think, allows there to be, you know, something that's very concretized, very receptor-based, you know, the lowest levels, but highly fictionalized up further on.
I mean, to put it in functional rule terms, you might think that the function of mechanisms at the higher levels is still to represent something organism salient. In that sense, you have to build representations to make sense of the system in an evolutionary context, say.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I mean, they would say, oh, well, sort of as you're going up the hierarchy, you're getting closer and closer to the more deeply embedded hidden causes, right? Which could be very abstract.
Yeah.
You know, the university causes me pain. You know, some sense.
That's abstract.
Pretty abstract, yeah.
I don't know if anybody has a room booked after this, but my time's officially up. Maybe it would be a good time to take a break, and the proposal is that if you were free, we could, those of us who are free, could walk over towards Framber House, whatever it's called, and continue the discussion while we're walking along, continue the discussion over lunch, at least for a short time. Johnny has to leave eventually, but he can join us for a short time. If that's acceptable, then let's just thank Johnny again. And we'll be back here for 2 weeks from now. So my students should pretty much think like they are obliged to do one this term. So it's just a matter of which week you want to do, Stephen and Simon. But the rest of you, of course, are very glad to hear from anybody in the room. So let me know.
Chris Buckley, really.